Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good morning, everybody out there in Blog Talk here in Atlanta. It's me, Wayne Klingman, with Chicago Outfit Blood in the Streets. And today we start a deep dive into the Dixie Mafia. And I, like most people out there, is intrigued with the subject, but the more I looked into it, the more I wasn't quite sure it was meant by the Dixie Mafia. Were we talking about people of Italian descent maybe in the South doing stuff? What exactly what it meant? You know, stuff you saw on TV would justify a whole arc on that subject. It even confused me even more. So I thought it'd be best for a deep dive to start off by bringing in one of the world's best experts on the mafia, on the mob, and organized crime, and everything to do with crime in the United States, especially that in Vegas. Therefore, with no further ado, we bring you on the very famous, the hugely good-looking, the man we call Headmaster, Larry Henry. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Wayne. I haven't heard that intro in a while and always am appreciative. Yes, the Dixie Mafia. Not well understood, but let's talk about it.
Please.
Well, if I may, let me sort of frame it a couple of ways in terms of what people think of. As you said in the introduction, Wayne, is it the traditional mafia that people think of? Is it drug smuggling? Is it involved in vice, prostitution, those sort of things? So really some sort of definition might be in order. You've always had there are really sort of three subsets when you talk about what's happening along the Gulf Coast. And the Gulf Coast, you know, generally extends from Corpus Christi in Texas down to Tampa, all the way across Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, so and the Gulf Coast of Alabama. So one of the things that occurred, the first group you referenced is the traditional mafia. That's Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, Santo Trafficante down in Tampa. They had enormous influence over all sorts of racketeering for decades from their power bases in those cities, including and especially in Trafficante's part down in Havana. Now, Marcello had big influence over the southeast in and around New Orleans, including Hot Springs up in Arkansas, which had illegal but open gambling for decades and was a haven for every mobster of any stature, from Al Capone to Albert Anastasia to Frank Costello. Lucky Luciano, in fact, was arrested in the 30s in Hot Springs. So there's that subset, Wayne. That's the traditional mafia. Then there's the group that became the subject of a lot of movies and books and so forth, which was the group of organized crime figures that worked with drug importers. You had John Roberts down in the Miami area, who had been involved with the traditional mafia, the Gambino family up in New York, moved down to Miami, got involved with Pablo Escobar, Jorge Ochoa, the Medellin cartel. Roberts worked with them. And then he also was associated to some degree with a guy named Barry Seal. You and I have talked about Barry Seal before. Barry Seal was a TWA pilot from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who was a drug smuggler for the cartel, the Medellin cartel, and became a federal informant. And later in the mid-80s, was shot to death by Colombian assassins at a halfway house in Baton Rouge. So there's that second subset. First subset, traditional mafia figures like Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante. Then you had people like John Roberts and Barry Seal, drug smugglers. Then the third subset I think that you're talking about more, Wayne, is the loose confederation of thugs and hoodlums and scam artists and murderers and killers. That's the Dixie Mafia. That Dixie Mafia, like Barry Seal in Baton Rouge, John Roberts down in Florida, Marcello and Trafficante, that group also was sort of aligned along the Gulf Coast, mainly in a town called Biloxi, which is on the coast in Mississippi, Biloxi and Gulfport, both about an hour from New Orleans. That's where that traditional Dixie Mafia was headquartered, because Biloxi was such a wide-open, corrupt city, and we'll get into that in a second. But let me just also say that that group, that third group, not the Marcelo Traficante types, not the Roberts Seal types, but that third group, the group thought of as the Dixie Mafia, identified that way loosely by the FBI, also operated on the border of Tennessee and Mississippi, north of the Gulf Coast, near a town called Corinth, Mississippi, north of Tupelo, where Elvis is from, a little bit east of Memphis. But so you had the Dixie Mafia down in Biloxi, then you had what was known as the State Line Mob, and those two groups were affiliated, had some of the same members up in North Mississippi on the Mississippi-Tennessee border. That became the subject of a movie in the 70s called Walking Tall, because right. that State Line Mob, which ran prostitution, illegal gambling, all sorts of other vice, they were responsible for the death of a sheriff up there, his wife. They tried to kill the sheriff, too. Killed his wife named Buford Pusser. Buford Pusser became the subject of a movie in the 70s called Walking Tall. And because of that, that State Line Mob became sort of under the microscope of the national media, and also some focus down in Biloxi, which also had its even bigger, maybe, share of scandals, including the assassination of a circuit court judge and the arrest of and conviction of a mayor who was involved in all sorts of illegal activity. So that sort of sets the table, Wayne. I know it didn't get into just the Dixie Mafia, but I wanted to set the table to sort of provide, if I could, some clarity on the difference with all those groups. And all those groups intersected, by the way, to some degree. Seal, Barry Seal, the drug runner from Baton Rouge, who ended up having the hub of his operations in a small town west of Little Rock in central Arkansas yeah. called Mena. He operated right. his drug hub out of that. Those groups intersected somewhat.
Well, without a doubt, they did. And I find myself, sir, that the more I looked into it, the more intersections become evident. And it's like, my God, it's far more than one might think of a couple people running moonshine back and forth. It's a multi-billion dollar business involved with everything from human trafficking to drug smuggling.
Unbelievable operation, including, again, and we'll talk about Vincent Sherry, the judge that they killed, him and his wife. So part of it is, you know, as you well know, it's like the death the other day of Cali, the Gambino boss in New York. There'll be a lot of books now and movies and things undoubtedly about him. He was sort of a lower key mob boss, but especially the media centers, Hollywood and the big media centers, until they get onto a story, it really doesn't become a part of the public dialogue until there's a movie or something big that comes out about it. And one of the things about the Dixie Mafia, minus Walking Tall, there have been books and there have been things like that, but it hasn't really exploded on the national scene the way some other things would that are located in media centers like New York. So as a result, you know, this enormously corrupt, crooked, and in all those cases, and you and I have talked about this before, Wayne, in all those cases, corruption exists because of, and those illegalities exist because of political corruption. You know, judges, prosecutors, people like that, being on the take. You know how it works. If a crime is committed, it's easy for a prosecutor to determine the evidence doesn't exist to go forward to court with a case. So you can get to a prosecutor or a judge and somebody like that. And that's what happened in Biloxi. Biloxi was enormously corrupt. In fact, the FBI, if you go to their website, it's interesting. The FBI, as I understand it, in the early 80s, had the entire sheriff's office was considered a criminal operation down there. One of the top law enforcement officers down there, a guy named Leroy Hobbs, ended up going to prison. He was completely in bed with that Dixie Mafia down there. That ran with no restraint. They controlled the strip clubs, illegal gambling, Motor for Hire. They were a real dastardly group that didn't have any shackles on them. They were uncontrolled, and you know, some of them are still around. I know you and I have loosely talked over Facebook with Phyllis Cook, whose dad and brother were killed, she suspects, by Dixie Mafia members. Ruled suicide, I think, in both cases, and she is she's endeavoring to find out what really happened, because, you know, when public officials are on the take in those sort of instances, it's very difficult to crack through and find out what really happened. I think that's what she's endeavoring to do. But just to sort of back up a little bit, what happened was this guy named Kirksey McCord Nix, who's still in prison, by the way. Some of these Dixie Mafia characters have died, but Kirksey Nix was a real sort of a kingpin. You know, it wasn't like a family that controlled, like the five families in New York. It was sort of a loose confederation of these figures who banded together to increase their power down along the Gulf Coast. But one of the key players was this guy Kirksey Nix, back down now from the Tennessee-Mississippi border, back down to the Gulf in Biloxi. Kirksey Nix, after he had been arrested in the and jailed in the death of a grocer in New Orleans, he had broken into this guy's house. They actually had a shootout, as I understand, in the house. The grocer and Nix had gotten shot, and the grocer was killed. He went to prison. So from prison, Nix ran this scam where he and his associates bribe in Angola, one of the notorious prisons in the country, in Louisiana. From Angola, Nix ran a scam in which he raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, hoping he could buy his way out of prison. He raised hundreds of thousands of dollars by bribing guards so they could use the phones to place ads in magazines, seeking to bilk gay people into believing that they would go to live with them if they had enough money to move there. So they were able to bilk people that way through this scam, this Lonely Heart scam operation, as the FBI calls it, hoping to buy their way out. So what happened was, there was a guy in Biloxi, the judge, there was a guy in Biloxi who was a lawyer named Halat, Pete Halat. I think his last name was pronounced Halat, H-A-L-A-T. So Halat was according to records, Halat was the guy who was supposedly collecting this money for Nix and his associates in Angola. He apparently was stealing some of the money. When that was discovered, he blamed it on his former law partner, a criminal defense attorney named Vincent Sherry, who became a circuit court judge, felony court judge. So Halat, who by this point had not been elected mayor of Biloxi, blamed it on his former law partner, Sherry. So Nix, the Dixie Mafia guy in Angola in prison, ordered a hit on the judge. This was in the late 70s, in the fall of 87, I believe. So a hitman went in, put super glue on his fingertips so the gun couldn't be traced, you know, back to him and all those sort of shenanigans, and then went in and killed a circuit court judge, a Mississippi circuit court judge, and his wife, who'd been a city council member and was on a crusade, by the way, to get rid of all these strip clubs and illegal gambling dens and those sort of things. So hitman killed the judge and his wife, and that led to that later led to the FBI sort of blowing up the whole Dixie Mafia thing. So I know it's sort of hard to follow, connect the dots with all that. I hope it somewhat made sense. But that's how the Dixie Mafia finally became sort of more exposed after the shooting death of that judge, which was obviously just a massive, massive scandal. It really exposed how corrupt the police department was down there. The meanwhile, this guy who blamed his former law partner, this guy Halat, this lawyer Halat, he became mayor of Biloxi and was under a cloud of suspicion the whole time, ended up going to prison himself in connection with this deal. He since has gotten out, by the way, and apparently is living along the Gulf Coast somewhere trying to live a quiet life. He's elderly now, so crazy story, has not really gotten a lot of the national focus that some of the other Mafia and mob stories. Even Barry Seal We talked about Barry Seal a moment ago, the pilot who smuggled drugs for the Medellin cartel. Barry Seal's story became really popular a couple of years ago in a movie called American Made starring Tom Cruise. So a lot more people know about Barry Seal now. So it really takes, Wayne, sometimes it takes a movie or a big television show to really bring it to the national consciousness, which probably is why the Dixie Mafia has not received the attention that others have, when in fact it was a massive scandal.
Oh, without a doubt, still going on today. I mean, when I look at, I try to follow the gambling news. I don't know why, but I do. And the stuff going on in Mississippi and those other states trying to legalize gambling, how that's going to work out, is amazing when you read about people with silly things they do, thinking they can get by with it. But as you said yourself, sir, if the city and state officials may not be the most honest people in the world, it's easier to do. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. The amount of graft, it seems to me, by reading the newspaper accounts, that still goes on in many of the Gulf Coast states.
Goes on everywhere. You know, one of the foremost mafia and crime writers in the country has 9 or so books to his name. Dan Moldea said it beautifully. I'm paraphrasing. I know I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he said, you know, without political corruption, there can't be organized crime. And that's really where it starts. It's like this sheriff, Leroy Hobbs, going down in along the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. I mean, through corruption. And Phyllis herself, by the way, Phyllis Cook, that we spoke about a moment ago, whose dad was a deputy sheriff and whose brother was killed, she thinks it was ruled suicide. She even concedes her dad was tied in with those guys. She has a picture of her dad. And I think I could have this wrong, but I think she has a picture of her dad playing cards with a guy named Towhead White, who was a really, really notorious state line mob figure. Again, part of that Dixie Mafia sort of loose confederation includes that state line mob up at the border of Mississippi and Tennessee, where Sheriff Pusser was killed, the guy who became the subject of the movie Walking Tall. Now, later, The Rock, I think, there was a later Walking Tall version, which was completely, changed. But when you look back to the one in the 70s, that was more about...
Yeah.
Sheriff whole state line mob. Yeah,
absolutely. The other one that you mentioned has Iraq, and it takes place out on the West Coast. I think one of the West, I think Washington State out. But again, same idea. The sheriff is, you know, a bunch of corrupt people, and the sheriff tries to fix the problem. He has issues doing so. The story about Puffer. Puffer is incredible to think that one man stood up and said, I'm not going to put up with this stuff anymore. I'm a law enforcement official. I'm going to try to do what I can do to clean up this environment, because we have a right to live in an honest area. And to think that people do stand up against great odds, against organized crime, some of them pay the price for doing so.
They do pay the price. In fact, he died in his mid-30s, something like that, in a car accident. There was some suspicion about whether some of those state line mob guys were involved, but they killed his wife. In fact, Kirksey Nix, the guy who is still in prison, I think he's in Terre Haute. They moved him from Angola down in Louisiana. He's the guy who ran that Lonely Heart scam. Has denied all along any involvement in Sheriff Pusser's wife's death. They fired at a car. The sheriff was in it with his wife. And I think they hit him in the face. I think, unless I have the story wrong, I think they hit him in the jaw, and killed his wife. So he was severely wounded. The level of corruption was staggering. At that state line up in Corinth, Mississippi, and Tennessee, but down along the Gulf Coast, again, from all the way from, you know, our friend Scott Ditchie, who's written beautifully about the mob in Tampa. Santo Trafficante. I mean, all along that Gulf Coast, New Orleans was completely under the thumb of Carlos Marcello. Yeah. So he had all sorts of bad guys operating with no constraint. Frank Costello, the prime minister from New York, worked with Marcello down in New Orleans on slot machines. And so the unfettered corruption. So every time I look, Wayne, at Las Vegas with the Chicago mobs, Bellagio, Frank Rosenthal. You look at New Orleans, Tampa, the Dixie Mafia down in Biloxi and at the state line. Every time I look at Chicago, New York, everywhere the mob has dominated, you have to look at the judges, the prosecutors, the cops. There are bad apples who let this stuff happen. And yes, there are very, very courageous, good people who stand up to it. And, you know, sometimes the results are unfortunate, like in the case of Sheriff Pusser in Tennessee on that with his battles with that state line mob. So, you know, go back and look at that. I think it was 1973 around that time that movie came out. It's dated now, obviously. The technology in those movies from that era obviously are not as advanced. But, you know, still an interesting movie.
Yeah, it's very watchable. It's very watchable. And I noticed that now we know the TV show Justified did a lot with the Dixie Mafia, and their effort was with cannabis. It was a big effort. They're trying to control the prime growing area of Kentucky, because once it became legal, they wanted to get on the ground and grow it legally and make all that money. It's just interesting to see. And again, it's a TV show, and they did, I'm sure, a lot of twisting and playing with the facts. It's just crazy. I think when you think about the amount of money that's out there, that, and why maybe we're fascinated with organized crime, with DIAM, is the amount of money that's out there that people really truly have no bones about how they get it, because it's incalculable wealth at times.
Yeah, well, it's always when I think when you look at every pocket where organized crime really thrives, it's always vice. It's going to always be vice. It'll be drugs, prostitution. In the case of the Dixie Mafia down along the Gulf Coast in Biloxi and Gulfport, Mississippi, it was those strip clubs and drugs and illegal gambling. You know, that's always sort of it's like someone said, every time you go in, and I remember growing up, I grew up in South Louisiana. I remember growing up, every barber was a bookie. You know, everybody, it's like somebody once said, every time you place a bet on a game with your friendly a bookie who's a barber, I knew guys in college who were bookies. That money is not, it's not these local guys. It's that money trickles there. It goes up to organized crime somehow. All that sort of activity is under the thumb of people who profit because they control politicians. You know, one of the things that's always interested me about organized crime, Wayne, is the intersection of politics and crime. It's clearly fascinating how they're able to operate because of the power, they being organized criminals, because of the power they have over public officials in whom we place our trust. You know, they're supposed to be the prosecutors, the sheriffs, the judges are supposed to be upholding justice, but in many cases justice doesn't occur because they're in the pocket of the people who control organized crime. And I think that's what happened along the Gulf Coast in Mississippi. I mean, to the point of murdering a judge.
Yeah.
To me, that's still a staggering story. You know, sort of transitioning over to San Antonio. You know, Woody Harrelson's dad. I know I'm kind of bouncing around here a little bit, but Woody Harrelson's dad, I think the only case of a federal judge ever being executed, was a drug dealer out of the El Paso area, and people connected down to Las Vegas contracted with Woody Harrelson's dad to kill a federal judge. So anytime a judge is killed, to me it's a huge story, and that's what happened along the Gulf Coast of Mississippi with this Dixie mob. They killed a judge and his wife, who was a city councilwoman running for mayor. She had lost one election and was thinking of running again, or had mounted a campaign, I'm not sure which, but there was some suspicion early on when they were killed that they may have been killed because the bad guys, the guys who controlled the strip clubs and the illegal gambling and that sort of thing, didn't want her crusading against all their vice. She was an anti-vice crusader, wanted to clean up the Gulf Coast. Now, I haven't been down to Biloxi and Gulfport in a while. I don't know what it's like down there now. I know they have legal casinos down there now, but it's always been sort of a rough and tumble place. I remember going down there a lot when I was in college and younger, and it was always sort of a place that just had sort of a cloud over it because of the vice that you knew existed. And when all of these things occurred, like the shooting of the judge, the killing of the judge and his wife. It really darkened the that whole sort of corrupt milieu that existed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is said in Las Vegas, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that even in the heyday of the amount of control of the casinos, somebody could walk down the street in Las Vegas and not have to worry too much about being hurt at all, right? But when you read about the Dixie Mafia and the Gulf Coast of the United States, you could be minding your own business and come out of that strip club and get rolled, or any number of things happen to you. You know, that's a scary thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Wayne. I'm sorry.
No, I apologize. I cut you off.
Yeah, that is, you know, and back sort of moving the focus back west to Las Vegas. You know, it when the mob controlled Las Vegas, the whole issue about was Las Vegas safer and so forth, really, there was a lot of crime. There were a lot of murders that happened. I mean, there were shootings. There were, you know, the hole in the wall gang, which was Tony Spilotro, the Chicago's overseer in Las Vegas. His underboss, a guy named Frank Collada, ran a group called the Hole in the Wall Gang. They would burst into homes and businesses by knocking a hole in the wall, rob those businesses, and take the loot out. So cars got blown up. People were missing in the desert with holes in their head. So, you know, there was a lot of shootings and bombings, just as along the Gulf Coast. You know, those guys were really, really, really bad and murderous and villainous and didn't hesitate to kill, and people went missing. And it called, you know, back to the case of someone like Phyllis Cook, whose own brother and dad allegedly committed suicide. You know, a lot of family pain involved. Really, because they control public officials, they really didn't face justice. Some of them did, as in the case of those who are still in prison or have been or have died in prison. You know, and you and I have talked about this with our friend Gary Jenkins. I'm bouncing around the map because I like to make parallels between the way political corruption does lead to organized crime efforts. You look at a place up in Kansas City, north of what I'm talking about with Mena, Arkansas, and Hot Springs and all that, up in Kansas City, you had the Civella crime family operating the skim out of Las Vegas at the Tropicana. Again, you know, they had a lot of political influence up in a place like Kansas City. So every time you look at places on the map, Chicago up where you are, Wayne, Milwaukee, of course, you know, had the Mad Bomber up there. So, you know, everywhere you look at these people had pockets of power, organized crime power. It was because of their influence with people who controlled the justice system.
Right, very much so. I think that's incredibly, because as time goes on, we see that change somewhat. I mean, we still don't know what all happened in Arkansas with Barry Seal. I mean, he claims, as so does an alter ego of Gary Webb, claims that the CIA was heavily involved in what was going on with Mena. Now, mind you, Mr. Webb is dead after he wrote a really good article for the Sun and Mercury. He can't speak anymore on that subject because the dead don't talk. But what's really happened? Will we ever know? And that's really interesting to think that if his accusations are indeed correct, you know, was the government involved in importing tons of cocaine in the United States? That's kind of scary.
The guns for weapons. You know, Gary Webb, who was, because as you noted with the San Jose Mercury News, ended up writing a book called Dark Alliance, became the subject of a movie called Kill the Messenger. Not that long ago. That movie came out only a few years ago. Yeah, you know, he even got criticized by other media outlets who allegedly had, you know, sources that they were close to in government, like the CIA. And that happens in the media world. You know, some people in the media will have friends that will mislead them even about the truth on something, and then they'll sort of attack other journalists, and that is what may have happened to Gary Webb. Yeah, so you know, his exposure of what Seal and others did in running guns south of the border down into Nicaragua and then running drugs back up from places like Colombia to pay for that operation, that CIA operation, still a matter of contention. And, you know, it always gets into what we're talking about, that nexus of political corruption, governmental influence, and organized crime. It's as long as will it ever go away is the question. Will there ever be people who can't be bought off, who can't be controlled by people who have a lot of money? And that's the thing. I saw something the other day. I think Pablo Escobar, the drug lord down in Medellin in Colombia, who ended up, beautiful book by Mark Bowden, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, called Killing Pablo, about the hunt for Pablo Escobar. I think he was in the early 90s. A chase for him ended with him being shot, I think, at around the age of 44, shot and killed. So they finally did catch up to him. But, you know, he like El Chapo, the recently arrested and convicted drug lord from Mexico, those guys were billionaires. Now, they lived a life on the run. They lived a life in hiding. They were shot at. They had to have, you know, bodyguards and on and on and on. But, you know, the amount of money that they make is staggering. With that money, they're able to just pour pockets into people who make, salaries that aren't equivalent to the danger of their jobs, like police officers. So they're able to pad the wallet of people like that and buy themselves the ability to escape justice. And will that ever go away? I don't know.
That's a good question, because as you read about, you have a law enforcement officer, be it the United States, be it Mexico, be it whatever, then that making a lot of money. You know, the life is on the line consistently, and they have an offer to look the other way because we have a truck moving some stuff that people want, right? Or we would be selling it to them. You know, what do you do? Do you make that traffic stop knowing what you can find on the truck? Would you look the other way because, well, you know, what the hell, next trucks can buy anyway, no matter what I do. It becomes very tempting to look the other way.
And, yes, and what happens is, too, it's like Biloxi down on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. Literally, it's a Gulf Coast town. I mean, there's a road, you know, it's on the water. So that town, Hot Springs in central Arkansas, just southwest of Little Rock in central Arkansas, back from the 20s through the 60s, towns like Hot Springs, like Biloxi, like Corinth, Mississippi, on the Tennessee and Mississippi border, it just becomes known among people in the underworld that's a safe haven. We've got the politicians under control. We've got them in our pocket. We play cards with them. We gamble with them. They're on our side. So it becomes known among people in the underworld that, hey, man, get out to Hot Springs. Get out to Biloxi. Now, it's changing those towns now. Hot Springs is not that way now in Biloxi, but when they are a hotbed of corruption and illegal activity, word gets out among people in the underworld that those towns are wide open and that we've got the people who are supposed to be dispensing justice. We've got them under control. So that's how the Dixie Mafia sort of, again, it was not a family. There was no like the Gambino family or it wasn't like that. It was a loose, as I said a moment ago, sort of a loose alliance of hoodlums, thugs, who came together in a wide open town and through that sort of confederation of illegality with public officials being under their thumb, were able to operate just openly. And it was, as I said, I remember as a kid going through a place like Biloxi. It was a rough and tumble place, man. It was a gritty, you know, it's always been pretty along the Gulf Coast, things like that, but it was always a gritty, tough town. And you don't know. You don't really know why when you're younger. You know, why is it that way? Why can't it be cleaned up? Why can't it be fixed? I remember growing up hearing about Barry Seal. I remember hearing about Carlos Marcello. And I always wondered, why can't somebody do something about these people? I didn't get, you know, when you're younger, you don't really get, when you're a kid, you don't understand political corruption. You know, I remember my dad telling me in Baton Rouge, where I grew up, he said that he and his friends would have, would have coffee at this place near where Barry Seal was ordered by a judge, a halfway house, a Salvation Army halfway house, joking. He and his friends would be having coffee and Barry Seal would come in and they would think, oh my gosh, you know, this guy, you know, we need to watch out because, you know, everybody knew that he was targeted. So you always wonder when you're younger until you understand how easily corruptible some public officials are, you just wonder why don't they do something about these people? So yeah, but now you know as you grow to an understanding of things, you see why, and you see it's because of that organized crime influence over public officials and the system of justice.
Right, and we have to be vigilant in making sure what's going on and do what we can do, be it, you know, participate in whatever voting we might want to do and be active in our communities. You know, I think a long way to hopefully slow it down and not stop it. But ultimately, it rests with us, the people, to speak up and cause an uproar if that's what it takes to try to get things changed. I know, sidebar, my father back in the 1960s had a bar up in Berwyn, Wisconsin, Central Wisconsin, a little tiny town. And we had go-go dancers. And we were across the street from the police station. And I always wondered for the years, why was it that my father had this bar and he had go-go dancers, right? And then it shut him down. Well, come to think of it, growing up, the people were the sheriff. I went to school with the sheriff's son. His father was at our bar, right? Many of the deputies were at our bar. I went to school with their kids, right? I was not going to shut my father down. I mean, I don't think they were being paid off. I don't. But they're going to the bar, right? They're going to my father's bar. They're having a good time. Ed wasn't hurting anybody. What the hell? We'll let him go slide on by.
That's a great story. I had not heard that story. That's a great story, Wayne. Yeah, when you're a kid, you don't understand that. And
right.
But, you know, which leads to, and I haven't talked to Phyllis yet. I think I may see her in a couple of months. And I know you've received some material, as I understand it, from Phyllis, but I think that
be
Phyllis Cook, whose dad and brother
were. Yes, sir.
She suspects killed by the Dixie Mafia, a coroner whose rulings have come under suspicion back in the 60s, ruled those death suicides. But it sounds like that may be some of what she's butting up against, which is that resistance from public officials to say what happened. I mean, because a lot of these people are still alive, and you know, you butt your head up against the wall trying to find out what happened. Have you talked to her? Did you receive
I talked to her numerous occasions. She's my interaction with her via your My World Summit page, which I want to thank you for doing. I reached out to her. That's why she's coming on the show. That's why we're doing the deep dive. And what is the Dixie Mafia, the idea, what was about, how it was involved in areas of corruption and crime and the like, so we can bring her on, tell her story, tell other people's story, and have people have an understanding of what potentially is going on in different parts of the country.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, she is relentless and has some people on her side who I think are fantastic investigators and fearless.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It sounds to me like she is getting closer. You know, justice needs to be done. I mean, if Skullduggery were involved in the death of her father and brother, clearly justice needs to be done, even all these years later. And as I understand it, her brother was killed or was ruled suicide. Apparently, he supposedly shot himself in the head with a 410 shotgun, but. As I understand it, and I know you'll get the story right from Phyllis, I may not have it right, but that occurred not long after Buford Pusser was shot, that sheriff, by the State Line mob, or his wife, I'm sorry. Yeah, he was shot. His wife was killed. Not long after that, apparently, her brother, quote, committed suicide. And so I think she suspects that it wasn't suicide, that he knew some things about that State Line mob shooting of the sheriff's wife. Yeah, so unless I'm mistaken, Wayne, I think that's part of what she's saying, correct? That they were involved in his death because he knew too much.
Absolutely. And again, she tells a very fascinating story. I'm happy to be able to help her tell that story. I've heard her do other podcasts before. She's a remarkable storyteller. And I know that in time and practicing telling the story, she's gotten better. I'm really looking forward to having her on the show. And you write about the difficulties that she and other people have trying to clean up what really happened. If you take the case by Arkansas, I'm going to miss me also, the airport, Menina, I apologize. They found two dead
Mena,
teenagers in a railroad.
Up in Mena.
Yep, they found two dead teenagers on the tracks. First of all, they went and claimed that these kids laid on the railroad track, got run over by the train, and then weird things happen with a suicide. And you find out the coroner's cropped his all get out, that he's involved with different people in state government going up to the Clintons. It's like, what's going on? And what? And often you read these stories or hear about these stories, and it can't possibly be true, right? While all the stories, there's too much conspiracies, it's too wild, it can't happen. This is the United States. And then years after the fact, you find out that, sorry, it did happen.
Yeah, I think, no, you're right, Wayne. I think what happens, it gets diluted on both sides. Like in the case of Mena, and almost every instance like this, there will always be people who are, quite honestly, you know, sort of way off base, and
right.
They'll even publish books and they'll have these wild, crazy theories that aren't true and dilute what could be the truth and steer people away from what the real facts are because their theories are so outlandish, get books published, dilutes the truth. So there's that. You've got that crowd that makes every investigation into something like the Dixie Mafia shootings seem like a conspiracy because some people have put out these wild conspiracies. So everything then seems like a conspiracy when you look into it. On the other side, you've got, it sounds like this is what Phyllis might be running into. You've got decades-old incidents which were covered up in the first place. Documents are missing. Evidence is missing. So without official documents, without, in the case of the death of her brother and dad, there was no court. There won't be any court transcripts because there were no court cases. It was ruled, both cases were ruled a homicide. So, I'm sorry, a suicide. So you don't have official police reports. You don't have court records. Generally, the way to verify is, as you know, Wayne, because you're a great digger yourself, generally the way to verify, to cut through the conspiracies, to cut through the hearsay is what are the records? You know, journalists, you always rely on the credible journalistic efforts because they will use documents. They'll use eyewitness accounts. They'll use verifiable sources to really get at what happened. In the case of something like her dad and her brother, you don't have documentation. So it's really hard to get at what really happened because those who covered it up, if in fact it were a cover up, if it weren't suicide, if it got covered up by corrupt public officials and there's no documentation, it's really hard to crack it. You have to get somebody who will say that that's what happened. So on one side, you've got the conspiracy theorists making it hard to get at what's true, and then you've got, on the other side, a lack of documentation, verifiable sources who can prove that it's true. So it's tough. It's tough to get at what really happened in some of the cases like that.
Right. It's fascinating that things such as the Freedom of Information Act become very, very critical because that's how we get information. I mean, from Godfather Frank, as I call him up in Milwaukee, we did a FOIA request, and it took about 6 to 9 weeks to get the information back. But boom, I got 1,300 pages of information that blew my mind. I did not even suspect was going on, right? Which opens, of course, you ask more questions because you get this information. And the difference between, and why we need things like Freedom of Information Act and other laws to make it a transparent government so we can get the information that we, the public, need to have in order to make informed decisions. And this is wild.
Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, I, as you know, I do a monthly post for the Mob Museum in Las Vegas called The Mob and Pop Culture, and I was just recently putting something together on looking into the whole Jimmy Hoffa situation. 1975, going on 44 years, different theories about who killed him, shot him, if in fact he was shot, where his body is, all those sort of theories. There are different experts who have really, really good sources and documentation that point to certain things. But I was talking to Eric Schon not long ago, the Fox News anchor who has a two-hour piece on Fox Nation about Jimmy Hoffa. And one of the things he talks about is he's calling for the release of all unredacted FBI files, governmental files, on Jimmy Hoffa, everything unredacted, so that we can get at the truth. I mean, the way to get at, and I agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, those documents should be released. As a journalist, I'm always in favor of, public scrutiny. And so to see documentation like you've gotten from Milwaukee, and man, you've done a fantastic job of digging that out. But to actually get the documentation does point us to answers that we don't know, unless we know,
right,
conspiracy theories aside, you know, people who speculate what happened versus what really happened in documentation makes a big difference. And I think that's one of the things with down in the on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, I think one of the things confronting Ms. Cook is you know, it's going, I think it's just difficult to find out what happened without talking to people who know for sure, because they were involved, that there was a cover-up, or the documentation is missing. And unless you can find some documentation, it really does come down to that, as you know from what you got on Milwaukee, which is fascinating.
Well, and you're right. And each day that goes by, more of these people, because we all get older, you know, will pass on, or their memories don't become as good as they used to be. Or because it's a file cabinet, the files got moved, and God only knows what happened to the files. You know, and it's simply because a file was lost doesn't make it a conspiracy-tied information. It means someone made a mistake, and we're people. We make these mistakes. That's why it's important, again, as we said before in the show and earlier shows as well, you know, things like the Freedom of Information Act, transparency in government, it becomes critically important so we can get the information that we need so badly. I mean, I found a great source today called Internet Archive. I never heard of it before, but I found it, I think, through a posting that was done on your site for the Mad World Summit. It's full of the most fascinating information I didn't know existed.
Yeah, you know, and it really does come down to that. When you look at our friend Gary Jenkins, I mentioned in Kansas City a moment ago, Gary was a police officer in Kansas City and has a site called Gangland Wire, which is, Gary's done a magnificent job of putting together the documentation, audio, to connect the Las Vegas and Kansas City skimming connection. Gary's got the actual audio of gangsters talking about the skim. He's got the documentation, the arrest reports. You can find the addresses. You can find – there's so much information in that documentation. Gary's got a great book called Leaving Vegas, which if you get the e-version of it, it links to the documents. And, you know, Gary's a fantastic digger himself, as is another Kansas City source who's also written some fantastic books about the Civella crime family and prior – crime families in Kansas City, Bill Owsley, former FBI agent up there. So it really does come down to the documentation, you know, the evidence, the proof. So you look at somebody like Gary Jenkins and Bill Owsley, who can back up what they're saying with documentation, audio, those sort of things, versus people who are speculating. And it's a big difference. You know, it really, if it's verifiable, then you know, it's more reliable if you can,
right,
verify what happens.
Which is
why I love that slug you got on the Milwaukee situation. I don't know what your plans are going forward, but I'm hoping you're working on putting together something to put that out.
We are. In fact, we're doing two things. One, I'm writing a book. The book should be out in about a month, 6 weeks.
Great.
Absolutely, yes. It's good to have a ghostwriter, and people know how to yankle them. Helps a lot. And second, we'll probably upload the documents because of the Freedom of Information Act report. I'm probably going to upload them up to the Internet Archive site so other people can use them as well. Because I'm a big believer, as you are, sir, the more information we share, the better off we all are.
Public needs to know, and that's why the First Amendment exists. In fact, I know you and I have talked privately and also I think publicly too about you have some theories, and I don't know whether this has been revealed in that slug of documents that you've got, but some suspicion that Balestrieri may have been involved in the Lefty Rosenthal car bombing and other things like that. I'm hoping that that slug of documents you have gets into a lot of that. I know Milwaukee had a lot of influence over Alan Glick, the casino owner in Las Vegas, who was recipient of Teamsters loans to build his properties, but then also became beholden to them, the Kansas City family, the Milwaukee family, the Chicago family. So I don't want to spoil anything that you've gotten yet, but I'm anticipating that and looking forward to seeing your book because I want to see whether those connections are there.
Well, I think fascinating. And this is way off subject from the Dixie Mafia, but I think
we've gotten off the Dixie Mafia. Yeah.
Is the one thing I did not expect. The information you find, you sometimes don't expect, right? Which makes it the whole fascinating stuff, right? I think one thing that I find when Phyllis, who went out of her way, I think she sent me probably nicely bound close to 1,000 pages of stuff on her own dime. I think postage alone to send it to me was a good $20. And the time that it took her to type away it and lay it out where I all to do is read it, I know what I'm reading, right? Means the woman cares about what happened to her family. And I owe a debt to her to make sure she has the ability to come on this show and tell that story and help her tell that story to as many people as she can, because maybe somebody else there knows something. Maybe all it does is help people understand what life was like back in Mississippi back in the day, so things can only get better. Does that make any sense?
It really does. And, man, I mean, it's just a great story. It hasn't really been told. The murder of a judge and a city councilwoman wife alone is just an incredible story. And just that whole Dixie mob influence over the Gulf Coast, the corrupt, gritty Gulf Coast, it's just an incredible story, Wayne. And now I haven't seen the material that you have. Does she, in that body of work, is there a lot of documentation? Is it news articles, just different things like that?
A lot of it's news articles, primary photos, stuff like that. Stuff I would call primary source material. Police reports, whole nine yards. I mean, one of the things I'll be doing, and I want to coordinate this, Phyllis, so I definitely don't want to step on her toes, is I'm going to be doing some Freedom of Information Act requests and see what might be laying around in the FBI office somewhere. Because one thing I have noticed is sometimes law enforcement organizations don't cooperate with each other very well, especially as some distrust between them at times, right? So I'm thinking that a FOIA request about the judge who died and his wife that died will produce documentation that nobody has seen. I think the same thing requesting other players in the situation will produce the same documentation. Also because I have a contact that works with organizations and state government when it comes to states legalized gambling and bookmaking, as we see now with some bookmaking being able to be done in all the United States. I think that source will be a way in to find out where I can find documents that might be of interest to what we're talking about. Because I think some of the bad people were tracked for some time and simply not tracked at the time or were able to be dealt with at the time these murders took place.
Well, I'm looking forward to what you get because it was the FBI, and I'm not sure anybody's requested those documents yet, Wayne. You may be the first one. I'm not sure what Phyllis has done. But it was the FBI, as you know, back then in the 80s and 90s, or more like the 90s, it took 10 years after the death, as I understand it, of that the murder of that judge in 87. It took about a decade to crack it. It took the FBI coming in. So it was the FBI that cracked it. An FBI agent who grew up on the Gulf Coast came down. And so I'm sure there's a wealth of documentation that the FBI has. I'm really eager to see what you get out of that because whether it leads to a resolution in her father and brother's deaths, obviously we're all hopeful that it does. But beyond that, just getting that documentation will lead to a lot of stories that haven't been told about that Dixie Mafia. It's just really sort of when you look at all the mafia stuff around the country, the five families in New York, Giancana and everything going on in Chicago, Capone before that, Las Vegas, when you look at all the mafia stories in the country, Tampa, one of the stories that really hasn't gotten the attention that would really make a fascinating movie and book, plus, is that whole Dixie Mafia story. I mean, again, a judge and his city council wife were murdered. If that had happened in a place where there's a lot more media attention, it would be massive. It's a really big story, and I'm not sure it's gotten the attention that it should, because there are some follow ups to it, I'm sure, that would come out of this.
Without a doubt, it's a fascinating story. Not only to us people who might be called organized crime geeks, if I may use that term, but simply someone at home might be reading about situations within the home stay, I think would find the stories fascinating. But as I see the clock is running down on time, can you please tell us where we can find your writings online for a moment, sir, please?
Yes, thank you, Wayne. I write, as I said a moment ago, I write a monthly blog for the Mob Museum in Las Vegas. It's called The Mob and Pop Culture. I generally focus on things like books and movies about the mob. So there is that. Now, also on Facebook, I've got a couple of pages. You are a fantastic contributor to them. One is called Las Vegas Mafia History. The other one is called Mob World Summit. So please, those who are interested, send me a request. They're Facebook groups, and a lot of people post a lot of really interesting things on those sites. So I welcome newcomers.
Yes, you're a great human being. You've done so much when it comes to educating the public and what's organized crime, especially what was going on in Vegas. I find that stuff really, really, truly fascinating. I mean,
Well, thank you, Wayne. I'm hoping the net result of this, too, is that people will be held accountable who haven't been so far.
Absolutely. Well, sir, I want to thank you again for all your time once again. With your business schedule running that school, which you're doing a great job of doing as well. I wish you guys would come up this way, because God knows we could use people like you in our school system.
I appreciate you saying that, Wayne. I always enjoy being doing this podcast with you, and I greatly appreciate you having me on.
All right, sir. Again, with that, then, sir, you have the best of days, and send up some warm weather, because it's not particularly warm up here yet.
Will do. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Good talking to you, my friend.
Yeah. Goodbye. Goodbye, sir. Thank you. That was the famous good-looking Larry Henry again. A great guy. You gotta check out his Facebook groups. You know, they're a really good one. Mob World Summit and the Vegas History one is absolutely fantastic. A lot of good stuff is there. Both places are rocking out like there's no tomorrow. I got to say a big thank you, a big shout-out thank you to, of course, Hooters Hotel and Casino in Vegas, yay, go them. The Hooters restaurant chain in particular, yay, go them. My good friend Heather with her group, Vegas Aces, which is a great place to go for information on how to play different table games, be in Vegas or different places you might play your table games, and legal casinos around the United States. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate y'all. It means a lot. With that, you have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon. Goodbye.